Okay. Just a little bit of beginning before I give the main talk. That there was a question last night about my statement that the Buddha discovered jhanas. Was it my statement? And I said, no, it was a Buddha statement. But I was quite tired last night, so I couldn't really remember where it was. And it is in the Anguttara Nikaya 9, number 45. I'll put it down here. Yeah, 42, sorry. In the Anguttara 9, 42. Where? You can check that out yourself. It's in the, if I was to Panchala Chanda. And it's also repeated in the Devaputta Samyutta as well. It's a very lovely little saying there, which when I read it really stood out, simply because it was not what I expected. And one of the reasons why the Buddha discovered those jhanas is to recall the story of the Bodhisattva's journey towards enlightenment. I did mention it's from the Mahasachaka Sutta, the 36th Sutta, in the Majjhima Nikaya, where he recalled his time under the rose apple tree. And then afterwards, he said this must be the way to Bodhi. And then I never continued on with the next part of that sutta, because it wasn't really relevant to what I was talking about on that day. But it continues on where the Buddha or the Bodhisattva says that it's very difficult, not impossible, but very difficult to attain that jhana with a body which is so emaciated and weak. Which is why that he gave up the very ascetic lifestyle he was following and started eating properly, sleeping and bathing. And that was considered by his five friends, who later became the first five disciples of Panchavalkya. It was considered by them to be giving up the path towards enlightenment. And they were so upset that the Bodhisattva, they didn't know he was a Bodhisattva, suspected he might be, but that he had given up sort of the spiritual life, aiming for enlightenment, because he was now eating well, bathing and sleeping. And so they abandoned him. It was only later on, when he came to be enlightened and went to visit his five friends in Sarnath, that they realized that something had changed in their friend. And he soon convinced them that he was a Sammasambuddha and that he could now teach them. And of course you all know that first teaching which he gave, which I often emphasize, was not the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. The first teaching was the middle way, just the first part of that sutta, to avoid the two extremes, Atta-kilamatanu yoga. And the word kilamata, I think you all know Pali as well, or probably better than I do, is those practices which tire and exhaust and weaken the body. And so it is those austere ascetic practices which he was doing. And he said it's very hard to achieve those jhanas because in that day, that middle way, the way between indulgence and austerity, was not really recognized as a valid path. Anyone who practices asceticism, austerities, that was considered the path which summoners, people who left the world, were supposed to follow. And the Buddha finding a way in between was actually quite revolutionary. And I think one of the reasons why the jhanas weren't around at that time, why the Buddha discovered it, because the means, the causes for jhanas weren't there. And those means, the austerities, the asceticism, that was to develop willpower. It takes a lot of will to be able to fast for such a long time, to endure physical pain, to go without sleep, willingly, willingly. It has to be from your willpower, because it goes against the demands and the pleading of your body to have some sleep. So you can see that those ascetic practices were very well associated with willpower. And even the Kamasukalikanu yoga, the practices which indulge in the pleasures of the five senses. And I'm always very careful not to say sense pleasures, because that confuses people. Kamasukalikanu yoga, the other extreme, only refers to the pleasures of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. Does not refer to the pleasures of the mind. And if anyone wants to check that out, if you don't know that for yourselves already, that's in the Arana Vibhanga Sutta. It's very, very clearly stated there. That's in the Majjhima Nikaya. And to distinguish between the pleasures to be sought and the pleasures to be avoided. Pleasures of the five senses of karma, that's K-long-A-M-A. The five sense pleasures to be avoided. The sixth sense pleasure of the mind to be followed. So that's an amazing discovery by the Buddha, to distinguish those pleasures and to realize that the pleasures of the jhanas are the path towards enlightenment. And as I was looking for that reference just this morning, for the Buddha discovered jhanas, I also got another famous reference, famous saying, which I always like. And that was Samadhi Mago, Asamadhi Kumago. Samadhi is the path. No samadhi is no path. And what is that? That's, write these down. This is like when you have a computer, you have a memory stick. This is my memory stick for my brain, my piece of paper. Where was that? Oh, that's right, Anguttara Nikaya 6. 6 is number 64. Samadhi is the path. No samadhi is no path at all. And samadhi is stillness. But that was just saying something about last night's questions and answers. Today, I wanted to talk about Satipatthana, and maybe in the afternoon talk just general mindfulness, because that is one of the subjects which people always like to talk about because of that tradition emerging from Myanmar of a vipassana tradition, a sukha vipassaka tradition, dry insight. And I tell many people that we are both hindered and privileged in our modern age. We are hindered because we are much more busy than monks in previous ages. We can do more things, and therefore we do more things. And we're also privileged because with that development of our world, we can also have much more access to information, talks on YouTube, the suttas on the computer, but also the wonderful ability to check things out, to do searches of words. They can get on a computer. If you can't do it, get someone else to get it out for you. And just type in a search for Sukha Vipassaka in the suttas, and you'll find no results. It was never said by the Buddha. That word came much later. So you can actually check things out so easily. When I was a young monk, you had to go through the text, searching page after page after page, looking for likely places you could find these things, but fortunately, so there's advantages and disadvantages of this. But in particular, the tradition, or some traditions, always claim that the Satipatthana, especially as described in the Satipatthana suttas, that is the core teachings of Buddhism. And they even say some very strange things. And I'll say about the strange things first of all, put them out of the way, before I can explain the Satipatthanas in a way which helps with one's meditation and one's path towards enlightenment. You know, the first thing is that Satipatthana has been claimed to be insight meditation. And it's something you do after Samatha meditation, calm meditation. And please use your brains. As Buddhist monks and nuns, we are supposed to be intelligent human beings. And remember the story of the Arahat Mahinda, who came to Sri Lanka, and before he would teach Devanampiyatis, the king, he gave him a riddle to see whether the people in Sri Lanka were intelligent enough to understand the Dhamma. And fortunately, the king Devanampiyatis, he actually solved that riddle. And as solving that riddle, it meant that he was intelligent and he was suitable to learn the Dhamma, as with all of the other people in Sri Lanka. Imagine what might have happened if King Devanampiyatis had not been able to solve that riddle of the mango tree. Probably Arahat Mahinda would have gone away, gone somewhere else. So it's important to have that intelligence. And so now you Western monks here, or those Sri Lankan monks who know English, I'm now going to give you a riddle to see if you have the intelligence to become enlightened. Okay, and I'll give you the answer at the end of this talk. What English word is an English word? A word you find in a dictionary. What English word begins with T? Ends with T? And has only got T in it. Begins with T, ends with T, has only got T in it. So anyway, I'll tell you the answer to that afterwards, to see whether you have the intelligence to get jhanas and get enlightened. But anyway, the Satipatthana Sutta is not insight. It is everything. It's part of the Eightfold Path. And I did mention at the very beginning of my talks that the Anapanasati Sutta says specifically, clearly, in the words of the Buddha, no one doubts this was said by the Buddha, anyone who practices the 16 stages of Anapanasati also, at the same time, simultaneously, concurrently. I'm just saying these words again and again and again, because that's what Pali is like. There was, if they can say three or four words rather than one, they'd always say three or four words. Just to make it absolutely certain, you'd never get confused. The Buddha said that anyone who does Anapanasati, the 16 stages, at the same time, concurrently, simultaneously, also practices Satipatthana. That they fulfill the four stages of Satipatthana. So it is the same practice. So just to sometimes make it clear to people, everything I've taught so far in this retreat is Satipatthana. I am a Satipatthana teacher. And people say, come on, Ajahn Brahm, you teach Samatha. I go, oh, come on. Be realistic, be honest, be smart. I teach Vipassana. Do I? Of course. I encourage insight. I spent all day yesterday talking about insight. And the causes of insight. And how to deal with insights. So it's just one and the same path looked at from different angles. Ajahn Chah's front of the hand, back of the hand. They're both there together. You can't split them up. So Anapanasati fulfills Satipatthana. So, the Satipatthana Sutta. Let's get rid of some very clear misunderstandings, first of all. And the main one, and I just cannot understand that how monks who should know Pali could actually say this, when they say that the Satipatthana is the only path to the arising of insight, to the extinguishing of the defilements, to the ending of suffering, to Nibbana. And it's, you all know that, surely, when the word ekayana, it's just such a simple error in Pali. It's not ekayana, which is a one path, it's ekayana. And it's so simple to see that that word is only used twice in the suttas. And you can do your search on the internet. You get the suttas. Where is the word ekayana used? It's only two places. One's in the Satipatthana Sutta, and the other one is in, now what was it again? The Sutta number 12 in the, it's the Greater Discourse on the Lion's Roar, I believe, maybe. Number 12, anyway. Where the Buddha says that he knows a person. This is, yes, right, the qualities of a Buddha. The Buddha knows the destinations of beings. So they practice in such a way that if they keep on practicing that way, it will certainly lead to the hell realms or the heaven realms or some other realm, because he can see the causes and effects, the law of karma. If you carry on that path, it will certainly lead to that result. And he gave the simile that there's a path in the jungle, and he knows that path very well. There's not a fork, there's not a left turn or a right turn, it only goes to one destination, which is a pit of burning coals. And he said that path is ekayana. It's a path which leads only to one destination. No left turn, no right turn, no other turn. So it means like a path like that. There's only one destination for it. Just like you may say that if you go, say, west from here, if you go west from here, it leads only one direction, to the ocean. And I can predict that with certainty. So that's like an ekayana. It only leads to one place. It's not just the only path. Because that only path, that is actually said to be the Eightfold Path consistently, many, many times. What is that path? It's the Eightfold Path. And in particular, one of my favorite sayings, this is 274 of the Dhammapada. I always like to repeat this. Eso wa mago nati anyo dasanasa visudhya. This is the only path for the purity of insight, referring to the Eightfold Path. So please, don't just practice Satipatthana and think that's going to get you to enlightenment. Don't just say, as long as I'm mindful, I can actually break into houses, I can sleep with other people's wives, I can take drugs as long as I'm mindful. Mindfulness is the only thing I need to do. Because unfortunately, ridiculous as that might sound, people have said that to me. And they got totally confused, you know, because of the focus on Satipatthana. But anyway, there are, for everyone of every type of practice of Satipatthana, there is the preparation, first of all. And one of those words in the preparation, which I often focus on, and ask other people to focus on it as well, is that before you engage in the Satipatthana practices, according to the Satipatthana suttas, you have to do the preparation of Vinaya Loke Abhija Domanasan. And as a Westerner, when I first looked at that, the translation was, having abandoned grief and covetousness towards the world, which to me was a very meaningless translation. Grief towards the world? I have grief if my auntie dies. I have grief if my football team gets relegated, but not for the world in general. And covetousness, what does that actually mean? That's such an ancient old word, which we don't use these days. And it didn't take long for me when you started reading the suttas in Pali, so you didn't get confused by inaccurate translations, that there you started to see the list of the Panchanivarana, the five hindrances, especially in the Anguttara Nikaya, that so often the first hindrance which most of you know as Karmachanda, it wasn't Karmachanda at all in that list. It was Loke Abhija, exactly as you find in the Satipatthana Suttas. So the list of the five hindrances would be Loke Abhija, and then Vyapada, Tinamita Uddhaccha Kukkaccha, and Vichikicca, the usual five hindrances, but they had a different word in front, Loke Abhija. So just on looking through the text, it becomes quite clear that Loke Abhija and Karmachanda mean the same thing, the first hindrance. And Domanasa, you found that in two places in the suttas, as an alternative for Vyapada. So in that context, it became quite clear to me that that part of the Satipatthana, applying to all four Satipatthanas, referred to the first two hindrances. And then you looked in the commentaries after I made that discovery myself. I like to make discoveries, but you find a little bit of disappointment to find that many people made that discovery a long time before you, that that's in the commentaries. The Loke Abhija means Karmachanda, Domanasa means Vyapada, refers to the first two hindrances. In the Atthakatha to the two Satipatthana suttas, the Mahasatipatthana in the Digha, and the Satipatthana number 10 in the Majjhima. They both agree that that means the first two hindrances. So whenever you're doing the Satipatthana or reading it, please remember that those words, grief and covetousness for the world, the Loke Abhija Domanasa, means the first two hindrances. And interestingly, the commentary says in Pali, and I think this has got some merit to it, when you say the first two of a well-known sequence, it also means the rest of the sequence as well. It's just abbreviation. So it's just, they say it means all the five hindrances. And the word Vinaya, just like similar link to the word Vinaya, it's like a training. So what the Vinaya with Loke Abhija Domanasang means, having weakened, having lessened, having restrained those five hindrances. Not abandoned them totally, because that's the job of jhanas. The job of what you've been doing before, the other factors, the Eightfold Paths, things like right view, things like samasankhapa, the second factor, things like your precepts, right speech, right action, right livelihood, and things like samavayama. Those things are supposed to be a preparation for being able to do the Satipatthana. Though without those, your hindrances are very, very strong, too strong to be able to do very much for the Satipatthana. Basically, you can just look at those first two hindrances, Karma Chanda, just this is desire for the world of the five senses. And you know that that stops you being able to be clear and meditate, to be really mindful. When you've got lust in your mind, or when you've got desire in the mind, even for small things, we start thinking and planning. And it's, you can see that most of your thoughts, your plans, are what the Buddha called karma vitakka. It's thoughts about the five sense world. Thoughts about how can I get Ajahn Brahm to come again when he leaves in a few days' time. How can I make sure that I can get back to my Aranya comfortably when the retreat finishes? How can I make sure that I get my shoes back which were eaten by the dog the other day? Those are called karma vitakka, anything to do with the world of the five senses. And the more that first hindrance is active, the more those thoughts will come up. You are actually just engaged in the five sense world. And not only that, even feelings in the body will keep coming up. Karma Chanda, it doesn't just mean the sensory pleasures. It just means indulgence, interest, entanglement is one of my best words in the world of the five senses. How comfortable is your cootie in the forest? You know, we've been doing research for our monks over in Perth. These days, you can be in the forest, but with solar power and high-tech batteries, you can get an aircon for your huts. For those of you who are Sri Lankan and not interested in cooling, but making it warmer, you know, up in the forest. And it's not that expensive. And we found only very cheap. It only takes an average of, what is it, half a kilowatt. Every half a kilowatt hour to run these modern aircons, which is very easy to get from solar power. So you don't need to connect to the mains, which is too expensive because you live off in the jungles. You can get, and I can give you all the information after this retreat, you can get aircon reverse cycle to keep your cooties just the right temperature. If you like it hot, hot, cold, cold, all powered by the sun. Now, what you're doing now is called karma vitaka. Always plan, I've got to find this out, I've got to learn this, I've got to get the money for it, I've got to get my dayakas to get me this. And you can see just how that can obsess the mind. So you won't be able to do any stillness or even any of any satipatthana or mindfulness, anything. Your mind is totally distracted. It's just not here. So, what do we actually mean by sati, mindfulness? Now, I have many, many stories, and the stories are not just for entertainment. They are really, really useful stories. But because they're stories, people remember them. So, this is one of my favorite stories. It might take a while, but we've got plenty of time. I'm giving so many talks, I wonder what I'm going to speak about, so I don't mind fleshing them out with stories. So, this was a story which was told to me while I was traveling in an airport. A gentleman came up, we had a conversation, he told me this story. And sometimes I wonder, people were asking me, was that a deva? It's weird, the story. I'd never heard it anywhere before. It's a Buddhist story, but this fellow said it was from the Middle East. And sometimes, you know, it's a great story, and maybe just, who knows, maybe it was. Devas are really incredible. They do exist, and they come in really weird forms, just to give me some more stories to teach other people. Who knows? If I was a deva, I'd do that to someone who's teaching the Dhamma. So anyway, he told me the story of one of the monks who was probably Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand. I imagine Sri Lanka would probably be a good place where this story would be set. Who was on Charika. You know, just wandering from place to place. Like Venerable Jnana Wimala in the old days. Never really staying just the two nights in the same place, except during the Was period, when we have to stay in one place without wandering. And so this old monk, who was wandering from place to place, one morning came to the very simple house of a farmer. And the farmer was a devout Buddhist and invited the monk to take some alms food, some bindabhata. And having filled the monk's bowl sufficiently for the day with whatever food he could get, he asked the old monk, the old venerable, soon the Was is going to begin. Have you got a residence for the Was yet? And the old monk said, actually, no. At which point the farmer went on the ground, put his hands up in reverent salutation and said, please, venerable, please come and stay with me. I may be a poor farmer, but it doesn't take that much to look after a monk. I can look after you. There is a river not far from here with a nice meadow. I can build a simple hut for you, and my wife will be able to cook you enough food. Even though we're poor, we have enough. It's a quiet, peaceful place. All I would ask from you, Venerable, is maybe once a week on a Poya day, please give us the precepts. Please give us a little Dharma teaching, and especially my two children. Please give them a few stories from the Jatakas, words of advice. And it's true, it doesn't take that much to look after a good monk. Indeed, when the monks from Ajahn Chah's monastery first went to UK, the chairman, or I think not the chairman at the time, he later became chairman of the English Sangha Trust, was an economist called Colin Ash. Very nice man, became a good friend. And Colin Ash was an economist, a professor working at Reading University, and also on the board of advisors for the Bank of England. So he was a very good economist, and also a member of the board, which was inviting these monks for the first time to UK. And many people were concerned, can we afford to look after a bhikkhu? How much would it cost? So being an economist, this gentleman took out pieces of paper and pens and a calculator and worked out how much it would cost in a year to look after a bhikkhu, knowing their lifestyle, knowing what they would needed. And he found out that to look after a bhikkhu in the West costs much less than to look after a dog. And many families in Europe look after dogs. They have their pet dogs. Sometimes they have two or three. And his discovery that looking after bhikkhus is much cheaper led him to suggest that every family should have one. Because there are similarities. The little dog lives in a kennel, a small hut in the garden of the house. For a monk, it's a slightly bigger kennel, but a similar design, just one room. And also, he said, another simile. Monks eat out of bowls. So do dogs. And you can take the dog for a walk in the morning, and I'm sure that if you ever stay with your family, it's wonderful to actually to go for a walk in the morning as well. There are many similarities. And also, your family dog is very kind and compassionate and gives you lots of metta. Just like monks do. So, there are some similarities. But in particular, the point was, it doesn't take that much to look after a good monk. So the poor farmer was very happy and not overburdened to look after his venerable. And for the whole wash season, he would give the monk food. And the monk every Poya day would actually give some bana to the husband, the farmer and his wife and the two children. And even the little dog got to love this kind monk. So after 3 months, the wash season, the venerable monk came to the farmhouse for the last time and announced to the farmer that tomorrow he will be leaving. That day was the Mahapavamana day, and the following morning he'll be carrying on his travels, not being attached to any one place. And at that, the poor farmer burst into tears, as did his wife. Even the children started crying at the news this wonderful, lovely monk was about to leave. And even the dog put his tail between his legs and started whining as dogs do. They all loved this old monk. When the old monk said, I have to leave, but he said, during this wash, my meditation was really deep and very powerful, and I developed some iddhis. In particular, I saw with the power of my mind that very close, closer than you would think, there is a huge buried treasure, lots of gold and money, which is a bhikkhu I don't need. I want you to have it, so you don't need to be poor anymore. But, said the old monk, you have to follow my instructions perfectly to find that treasure. So even though they were sad, the old monk was going to go. They were excited that the next day they'd be rich, because they knew that old monks don't lie. So they listened carefully. He said, tomorrow morning, at dawn, go to the doorway of your house, your little farmhouse. Take your bow and arrow, which you use for hunting. And, he said, as the sun rises, pick up the bow and arrow. Face the rising sun. And when the disk of the sun rises above the horizon, separates, point the bow and arrow in the direction of that sun and let the arrow fly. And where the arrow falls, there you will find the great treasure. Follow my instructions and you will be rich. And even though they were sad that the old monk was going, that night they hardly slept, knowing tomorrow they'd be wealthy. So early in the morning, the farmer stood at the door of his house. When the sun started to rise, he picked up the bow and arrow. As the sun rose further, he pointed the bow and arrow in the direction of the rising sun. As the sun parted from the horizon, he shot that arrow. It went a long way. They all ran after it, including the two children and the dog and the wife. And being in Asia, they got the wife to dig the hole. Does that happen in Sri Lanka? No. It does in Thailand. But anyway, she dug the hole. She dug it deeper and deeper and deeper. And what did she find? Nothing. Nothing. Only big trouble. Because that arrow landed in a field belonging to a lawyer. And the lawyer said, that's against the law to destroy other people's property. I am going to take you to court. I'm going to sue you. I'm going to take everything you've got because you destroyed my field. And the woman said, it's not my fault. My husband told me to do it. And the husband said, it's not my fault. This old monk said we'll find a treasure. And at that the lawyer said, did you say, old monk? Yeah. I'm a Buddhist too, said the lawyer. And old monks don't lie. What did he tell you? And when they told him the instructions, the lawyer said, ah, you made a big mistake. I know what you did wrong. Look at you. You're a poor farmer. You hardly eat very much. I'm a big, fat, strong lawyer. I can shoot that arrow much farther than you can. I will shoot it tomorrow. And I'll make a deal. We'll split the treasure 51%, 49%. And he made out a contract and made them sign it. Because that's what lawyers do. And they had no choice. So the following morning, the lawyer was there at the doorway of the house. As the sun rose, picked up the bow and arrow. As the sun parted from the horizon, he shot the bow and arrow in the direction of the rising sun. They all ran after it, and this time it was the husband's job to dig the hole. He dug, dug, dug. And what did he find? Nothing, only more trouble. Because this time it landed in a field belonging to the general in the army. And he came with his soldiers. And he said, what are you doing? Destroying my field. Cut off their heads, he told the soldiers. And in Thailand, that might happen. Maybe not in Sri Lanka, because the generals have lots of power. So, cut off their heads. And the lawyer said, it's not my fault. The farmer said, the old monk said to him, there'll be a big treasure here. And the general said, did you say, old monk? Said, yes, because the general said, I'm a Buddhist too. So what did he say? And when the instructions were told to the general said, ah, what do lay people know about shooting a bow and arrow? You have to be in the military, trained. I've been trained all my life in archery. I will shoot that arrow in the morning. We'll split the treasure three ways. You don't need contracts. You know, I'm a general. You can trust me. And I'm sure we'll find the treasure tomorrow, because old monks don't lie. So the following morning, the general was at the doorway of the house. And at this point, I say, there's not much more to go, so please be patient. that Jed was at the house and he tried to follow the instructions, facing the rising sun. And the moment the sun lifted up from the horizon, he shot the arrow in the direction of the rising sun. It went a long way because the general was a professional. They all ran after it. And this time, the lawyer had to dig the hole. He dug, dug, dug. And what did he find? Real trouble this time. Because that arrow landed in the field belonging to His Majesty the King. And the royal guard arrested all of them, including the general, and brought them into the presence of His Majesty the King. And the king told him, "General, of all people, you should know that it's a capital offense to destroy royal property. I will have to execute all of you, including the dog who was there as well." And the general said, "Your Majesty, it's not my fault. The lawyer said that we'd find a treasure here." And the lawyer said, "No, that's what the farmer told me." And the farmer said, "The old monk said we'd find a treasure." At which the king said, "Did you say old monk? Because I'm a Buddhist too," said His Majesty. "What did the old monk say?" And they repeated the instructions the old monk said. And the king said, "I can't work this out. There should be a treasure there. Because old monks don't lie." And he said, "I will give a stay on your sentence. I won't execute you yet. But I'll keep you all in jail until I can find that old monk and discover the meaning of this." So he put them all in jail, including the dog, and sent out his soldiers to look for that old monk. They soon found him and brought him to see the king. And the king said to the old monk in front of all the others, the farmer, his wife, two children, the dog, the lawyer, the general, he said, "You've got all these people into very serious trouble. They are to be executed. Why?" And the old man said, "Your Majesty, it's because they never followed my instructions." "What do you mean?" said the king. And the monk said, "Your Majesty, I invite you to that house tomorrow morning. I will give you the instructions personally, and I guarantee you'll find that treasure, because I'm a monk, old monks don't lie. And I just ask you to please divide it four ways. Your share, one quarter, is enough to satisfy a king. And how much more would it satisfy this poor family?" And the king was interested and agreed. So the following morning the king was there. And at dawn, he walked to the entrance to the house, the doorway. He turned to the old monk, and the old monk nodded, "Correct, Your Majesty." As the sun began to rise above the horizon, he picked up the bow and arrow, and he pointed it in the direction of the rising sun. He turned to the monk, and the monk said, "Correct, Your Majesty." And as the sun was about to rise, he was about to shoot the arrow in the direction of the rising sun, and he turned around to the monk, and the monk said, "No, wrong, Your Majesty. I told everybody to let the arrow fly, not to shoot the arrow." And the king thought for a moment, and he got it straight away, just like King Dewanampiyatis got it. Instead of shooting the arrow, he opened up his thumb and forefinger, and the arrow flew straight down between his legs, right where he was standing. And there they dug a small hole and found an immense treasure, enough that that little dog ate the best food out of a golden bowl for the rest of his life, even his puppies also. And the old monk said, "That's not the riches which I really meant. The treasure of letting the arrow of wanting, craving, go. And if you let the arrow of craving fall, you let it fly, where does it go? Right between your feet, right where you're standing, sitting, right now. Because in this present moment, right here, right now, that is where the treasure is found. That is where the Dhamma lives. That's where nimittas and jhanas live. Not over there. Not way over there. Not way back over there. But right where you are now. Right where you are sitting. So, are you shooting an arrow of craving trying to get jhanas? Are you going back in the past, shooting way back over there somewhere? Or are you letting the arrow of wanting drop? And where it falls is right where you are. And there you will find a great treasure. I know that. You can trust me, you know why. Because I am an old monk now. And old monks don't lie. So that is a lovely story, which you can tell any dayaka, or even the children of your dayakas. It's very easy to understand, and it's very meaningful, because how many times people search for the treasure. I'm going to really try hard, and maybe by tomorrow I might get my jhanas. I'm going to stay up all night. Always going off into the future. That's not where mindfulness is. Mindfulness is right here, right now. And the second story, which will, I'll do Satipatthana this afternoon more. The second story, which enhances the meaning of mindfulness. And it was a little story, which I used it as a foundation of my meditation instructions to my monks in Bodhidharma Monastery for a whole range retreat. This is a core teaching I want you to focus on for this 3 months. And it was a teaching which some of you may know. You think it's just a lay teaching. No, the Emperor's Three Questions from Leo Tolstoy. Now, I read this when I was in his book of short stories when I was a student. It really changed a lot of the way I acted in life. I didn't realize just what a great teaching on sati this was. The Emperor's Three Questions was a story by the Russian author Tolstoy, trying to find a better religion, because all these people in monks, nuns, priests, always arguing with one another. Who's right and who's wrong? And he wanted something a bit more meaningful and simple, which was for his own spiritual attainments, but also to do his job as a king. And eventually he realized there's only 3 questions he needs to know the answer to. And those 3 questions became the Emperor's 3 questions. Who is the most important person? What is the most important thing to do? And when is the most important time? And it wasn't the why. Ajahn Chah answered that. This is the who, the when, and the what to do. And of course, the first question was the first question was the when. When is the most important time? That's always now. Because now is where your future is being made. Now is the only time you have. If you want jhanas or enlightenment, the only time you can do anything about that is right now. This is where your future is made. Now, that's an obvious one. But the who is the most important person really sort of stumped me. I could not get it at first. And it was the person right in front of you, whoever that happens to be. And the most important thing to do is just to care. Which was a combination of mindfulness and kindness. To care means, you know, looking after this moment with a sense of kindness and acceptance. And that was a very useful teaching for life. But it's only after many years I thought that was a wonderful explanation of what mindfulness is. Of course, it only exists in now. But for meditation, whatever is in front of your mind right now, is the most important meditation object in the world. Don't try to get rid of it. If you are sleepy, because it's right here, right now, right in front of your mind, that's where the treasure lies. Just be with it. Be aware of whatever it is right in your mind, right now. And don't try and get rid of it. Don't try and develop it. Don't try and analyze it. Care for it. And that became a wonderful description of mindfulness and right effort, which led many monks to very deep meditations. Such simple teachings. always possible when you close your eyes and start meditating. Now is the only time there is. What are you aware of right now? Right now. That is the most important meditation object in the whole world. Just because it's not nimittas and jhanas, don't try and get rid of it for something better. Don't try and demean it. It's not worth anything. It's just a lustful thought, or it's just restlessness. Please give it importance and care for it right now. You don't find, if you practice like this, you don't find that the mind just continues on these stupid thoughts. What happens, because you are practicing mindfulness, awareness of what's happening right now, and you're caring for it, making peace with it, being kind to it, being gentle with it, you're practicing the second factor of the Eightfold Path. I call that right intention is right meditation karma. Karma is intention. So if you get the right intention, the right attitude to what you're doing, it has to lead to the good vipaka. And in meditation, that vipaka is peace and stillness and freedom. So right now, whatever you're aware of, don't try and get rid of it. Don't try and judge it. Don't try and indulge in it. Just care for it. And then you find that is a wonderful explanation of mindfulness together with some right effort based on right intention, which leads to incredible peaceful states of mind. You're dropping the arrow of craving. You're being mindful. Craving means this is not good enough, I want to get rid of it. This is lust. Shouldn't be lustful. Get rid of it. Get out of here. Just like that emperor in the, that monster in the emperor's palace simile. If you do that, the problem gets worse, bigger, more of a problem. If you care for it, it gets smaller and vanishes. That is my understanding of sati. The Satipatthana says where you put that sati and how it works to uncover deep insights. But as said at the beginning, before you even practice Satipatthana, vinaya loke abhijja dhammanasa, having restrained, suppressed, got rid of most of kamachanda and vyapada towards anything, whatever object you have. No kamachanda, no vyapada, just kindness, letting be. If you do that, you find how easy it is to meditate. Said last night, sometimes we give too many instructions. And when you give many instructions, it just opens up for more questions. And you answer one question and three more questions comes up. I've always noticed when I answer questions, they're never finished. Doesn't matter how long we spend answering questions. If it does go on all night, there'll be still some more questions in the next day. But if you learn just simple Dhamma, now is the only time you ever have. It's Bhadekavata Sutta. The thing right in front of you. When you close your eyes, when you're aware, what are you aware of? That is the most important thing in the whole world. Which means you really pay attention to it. If it's not important, you don't see it. You try and get rid of it, which is hindrances. This is the most important thing in the whole world. Just be kind. And then you find the meditation develops. So easy. In that Thousand Petal Lotus Sutta, not Sutta, haven't got to that stage yet. My story, Thousand Petal Lotus. It is the light and the warmth of the sun opens a lotus. The awareness and the kindness gets you into the deep states of meditation. But if you go off into the future, if this stage of meditation you're in now is not good enough, you want something more. Your meditation blocks, doesn't go on anywhere. You get stuck. It's wanting again. But if you give importance to this moment, well, whatever it is, then the meditation proceeds. Easy, without any hindrance. That is how you get into deep meditation. It makes it so simple, so easy. Just whatever I'm aware of now, right now, I'm tired. That's really important. I'm just going to be with the tiredness. Give it importance and care for it. Because I don't fight it, it vanishes so fast. My mind is restless. Like I mentioned that story of the sexy thought time. Trying to block those thoughts out, fight them, didn't work. It made it worse. Have you ever tried that? Been really restless and tried to stop your mind? And just got even more tired and frustrated, even angry. And unfortunately, some monks disrobe. They think, I can't meditate. Everyone can meditate if they get the right instructions. But they've got to follow the instructions like the old monks said to those people. Sometimes it's very hard to give the instructions. But here, this is the most important thing right now. And just have this beautiful mind of caring. Not of trying to get rid of, not trying to develop, not trying to get anywhere. And then you go deeper into this moment. That's where you find the treasures. More than you could ever spend. Nimittas and the jhanas and even the magapala. People will try for years trying to get enlightened. I told that story, I think it was on the interview. I said I wouldn't tell the story in public, but I'm now going to break that little promise because it's relevant here. The reason I don't like telling this in public is because sometimes people get the wrong idea and decide that that's the practice of meditation for them. That was a story of the nun, I think her name was Wajira, 7 years as a bhikkhuni and never a moment of peace in her life. And she didn't want to disrobe, but it was a waste of time carrying on as a nun. So, what alternative did she have? And for those of you who don't know, that in the Pali, especially in the Terigata, there's always mention of the three crooked things. And she said, I don't want to go back to the three crooked things. And those three crooked things meant this. Meant the ladle to making the curries. He said, I don't want any more housework. And the crooked broom for sweeping the house. No, none of that. You don't want to go to that. And the third crooked thing she didn't want to go back to was the husband. Those in Pali were the three crooked things. Cooking, housework and husbands. So he said, I'm not going to go back to that. So there's only one choice. She took a length of rope, went to the forest. Did I tell the story? Was it just an interview? No, interest. She went to the forest and she climbed a tree. This is in the Terigata. And she tied one end of that rope to a big branch of the tree and the other one around her neck. She was just about to jump off to commit suicide. Where? She had her first experience of liberation. That was cutting it close. So I don't encourage you to do that. But why did that happen? You know, 7 years she was trying, using willpower, trying to get her mind still, fighting the defilements. Now, first time, she let go. She gave up. Or just like one of my disciples, she's now I shouldn't give the game away. She's now a nun at Dhammasara Monastery. And she was from Malaysia. And she was on one of my retreats in Thailand. And she was meditating and meditating and meditating. Done lots of good karma. Very intelligent. And got nowhere, absolutely nowhere in her meditation. And the retreat finished, but the taxi she ordered to take her to the airport another hour before it arrived. So she went into the meditation hall and sat down. She said, to kill time. Nothing else to do. Just to kill time. And after the hour, she came to see me. On her knees, with her hands up. Oh, Ajahn Brahm, I just had the most wonderful experience. Oh, at last it's happened. And really wonderful meditations. Oh. I don't know if that was good acting, but I tried to I tried to reproduce just her incredible piti sukha when she just got the first jhana for the first time ever. And this was the afterglow. She was so happy. And I said, you know why that happened this time? 9 days you've been meditating, your butt sore. You know why this happened now? Because you didn't even try. You let go. That should be an understanding. Only when you let this moment be, and let the arrow of craving fly, there you will find the great treasure. That is the importance of mindfulness. So there we go. That's the talk for this morning. This afternoon I'll get back to Satipatthana. I promise, maybe, who knows. Future's uncertain. Oh, yes. How many people got that? Yes? Sorry? No, that ends with A. The answer... Exactly. Teapot. The word teapot begins with T, ends with T, and you only put T in it. It's a teapot. Now, Venerable, you have the qualities to understand the Dhamma. Congratulations. Sorry? TNC, that's got a bomb in it, that's got an explosion. Teapot is the answer. No, it can be one word, teapot. Okay. Very good. We have a potential arahat in the Sangha here. Very good. Okay, enough for today.